Good morning. The AFL pre-season's now complete. The glimpses given and the impressions made left for us to ponder and to assess. The AFL will this afternoon make its views clear on the rules with broad approval for 666 and intense debate around the 50-metre penalties and restrictions on the runners. Given all the work that has been done to lead footy here, it's hard to imagine that Steve Hocking would flinch now. Still, it'll make for a lively week, particularly when the coaches come together with the AFL on Thursday. We live the journey of the season with Nathan Buckley in 2018, and we will do so again this year. He'll be in the studio shortly to begin his weekly slot after the experience of Morwell yesterday. More broadly, there's the barrier draw for the All-Star Mile and the build-up to the Australian Grand Prix, which we will indulge in as the morning unfolds. But let's start with Essendon. There's a small number of teams being fitted up in the rather curious category I always think of, finals or bust. The Bombers seem to be top of that list. What does two losses in the JLT do to expectation and what lies in store? It's Essendon Membership Day here at SEN, and it's the perfect chance to have the Chief Executive, Xavier Campbell, in the studio. Xavier, welcome to SEN.
Thanks for having me, Jared.
What does two JLT losses do to the lead up to the season?
Well, not an enormous amount, obviously. It's more about probably the way you're playing to the coaching staff are most intently focused on. So for us, you know, there's slightly new defensive structure our guys are starting to focus on, some new rules to adapt to. All in all, we probably would have liked a bit more consistency in that process, but I feel pretty confident going to round one though.
All right, so just tap into your supporter base for us as we're specifically talking to your members today. Is what do you sense from them coming to 2019?
I think our supporter base want to see improvement. You know, they want to see consistency. They want to see a team that competes hard four quarters every week in increasingly competitive competition. You know, we're speaking about that earlier today, that you've got a competition that is more even than it's ever been, and it's a good thing. You know, we want to see that. But we see with our list, you know, we've got great talent on our list. We've spoken about that on a number of occasions. We've got good coaching staff, and they want to see improvement year on year, and I think they'll see that.
Do you think there's impatience?
I think for many supporter bases is impatience. I mean, everyone wants success. That was probably a really hard part for our list management team and others to build a list strategy that wasn't necessarily going to be a flash in the pan, that was hopefully going to be sustainable to build for a period of, you know, opportunity to achieve success. And I think we've been able to do that. Our under 25 list is really strong, and that's been a very deliberate strategy. So we all want to achieve success. There's no doubt about that. But you've got, you know, 17 competitors that are all trying to do the same thing as well.
What about the very specific goal of making the finals?
Yeah, I think we're like any other team. We want to challenge to playing finals. And clearly, you know, for us, we want to be challenging to win finals games. And that's no different to so many others. But we want to do it in a way that we think can be sustainable over a period of time. And that's, you know, that's been a big focus for John and his coaching staff, a big focus for the list management committee. And, you know, I do feel like we're on the right path.
Are you ready now or are you more of a futures prospect?
I think we're coming to a period where we can absolutely do it over a sustainable period of time. Whether this year's the year, I think, you know, I'd like to think we are playing finals this year. Like all of, not John and his coaches, like the players, that's the ambition. A lot can change in the period of time. There's injuries, a whole range of other factors, but our focus has to be on the here and now, keeping our focus on round one with GWS. And it sounds cliche, but it's absolutely true. You have to be focused on the process more than the output, more than the outcome. And that's how our coaching staff have taken that.
Were there lessons from the start of last year that were learnt and are heeded as you approached the new season?
Yeah, I think there was. I think yeah, we got in there and there's maybe a little bit of misalignment around some of the things we're doing. I think John worked really hard to ensure, and with Dan Richardson as well, to ensure that focus was sharpened. And we got to a point where we played, you know, when we got to, it was at the end of round eight, and I remember thinking, all right, what are our key objectives now between now and the end of the year? We were two and six, and that was it wasn't the ideal position by any stretch. And our focus was really about the development of younger players, the style of football, and then particular wins and losses. And whether people like it or not, wins and losses have to still be part of a key performance indicator. And we were able to identify a clear brand of football, and that was the pressure. It was fast moving, it was high scoring. We were able to find some young players come through the system that shown that they could be, you know, really, you know, 10-year players, 12-year players, 150-game players. And we were able to do that, and we want to continue that momentum going into this year as well.
Did you review things at the end of last year, or did that period actually give you, no, that's where we planted our flag, that's the evidence that we built, and thus the journey continues on almost from round nine without what might typically happen at the end of the season?
Yeah, I think the latter. I think that's right. I think it brought forward a sharper focus on where our improvement was going to come from. Clearly, you know, Dan started to look at, all right, who's going to add the most to our coaching structure, and that was quite a deliberate focus to then, you know, gave us probably a head start around some competitors around who we wanted to target then, and obviously Ben Rutten was one that Dan really sharpened his focus on, and that was right, and Ben's already been able to add enormous value to an existing coaching group, Hayden Skipworth and others that our players really resonate with. And see, you know, I feel like we're on the right path, but the landscape changes and moves really, really quickly. And you know, there's so many good teams in this competition that you know it's a challenge week to week.
Do you feel like you've given John Worsfold everything that he needs around him as he marches on?
You know, I think in John's words, he feels comfortable with everything he's receiving, with the structure we've put around him, with the playing group. But it's still ensuring that he's already adjusting his defensive game plan this year, and that's a year-on-year piece. And you sort of saw that through our JLT form, where there's still some work to be done on that, and that John and Dyson have spoken to that openly over the last week. So you still see elements that are still a work in process. But generally speaking, I think John's pretty comfortable where things are at.
Do you actively manage expectations, or do you let Essendon, as the power that it has been, the power that it wants to be, run free?
It's difficult. And I'm going to be totally honest, as a big team in Melbourne, there is an impatience, absolutely. And that's not just for our club, it's for many, many clubs. And you consider over a long period of time, Essendon hasn't had the success that the members would have liked, that I would have liked, that others would have liked. It doesn't mean you just deserve it now. I think there's an element of trying to temper that expectation a little bit. You know, when you look at the competition this year, you've got, you know, Richmond, Melbourne, Adelaide, you know, Collingwood, West Coast, GWS. You've got some really good sides in that competition. For us, as I said earlier, that's a deliberate focus for us with a much younger list to build for a period where we can really compete, because you need so many things to go right in this day and age. It's full of opportunity, but also if you slight slip up and you can really be burnt. And for us, coming to that, we're coming to a period now where we really feel we can compete for a period of time.
In 2019, how significant is membership for... Well, for every club, for your club, how big do you need your numbers to be to get what you need out of it?
Yeah, I mean, we've had such a loyal, passionate fan base. And every club will say that. And I say that from the context of the position that we've been through and have come out of. And to be at nearly 80,000 last year, one of the few clubs to really experience significant growth year on year from 2017 to 2018. And in the importance of, you know, have really a membership landscape that's a little bit stagnant across the entire competition, to continue to drive growth across a main revenue stream to underpin the investment back into your football and the whole range of other initiatives. We've got a facility expansion and other things like that, which we feel are really important to the vision of us achieving the vision as a football club. It's incredibly important. And increasing pressure on other traditional revenues makes it even more important.
Is it... So you mentioned stagnant there. So it's over $1 million industry-wide. Is membership almost maxed out?
I wouldn't say it's maxed out. It's just challenging clubs to think differently about how they engage with their members, how they bring them to a point where they're prepared to invest when there is just so many entertainment options out there now. And this is not, we're not the only sport that's challenged by this. The NFL in America has, you know, they've had some real challenges, both from a broadcast perspective and from a participation perspective. The NBA is probably a bit the opposite. For us, the same sort of challenges we're going through now. You'll see that in terms of the pressure that comes on broadcast and where that's going to come from, you know, the key industry revenue stream and what happens there. It's really difficult to work out what that looks like into the future, because that landscape shifts so quickly. But it's up to the clubs to be innovative and think outside the square to ensure they understand what their members value above and beyond just winning, which is clearly the most important element.
And then growing revenue in other streams. So how real is that for a club like Essendon?
Very. Yeah, it's in the last 24 months, if you think about the incremental investment we've made in different areas of our business, we've created an investments and strategy division. We've got an investment banker working it, a guy called Tom Swift from spent some time at West Coast, was with Citibank after that, so understands it comes from a unique perspective because he understands the investment space but understands AFL football. Brent Humphries is our chief strategy officer, and we wouldn't have had that. Even 5 years ago, we didn't even thought about putting someone in place that for many back then probably would have seemed like a dead investment. But the reality is now the landscape is shifting so quickly. It's so competitive. You have to think about what's the next frontier for us to be able to drive revenues to underpin the core business, which is obviously men's football, but then coming in women's football is going to be part of that core business as well, which is another investment stream. So it's significant when people talk at esports and things like that. I mean, initially, you can imagine trying to pitch esports to your board.
Yep.
You know, this is probably 2.5 years ago. So what's esports? Well, people actually pay to watch other people play computer games. Well, it creates a new set of inventory for us to be able to commercialise. It creates a new way to connect with a demographic we're not speaking to that much. And a lot of people will think that 15 to 35 year old male, which is you would think is a lifeblood of football club. That's our most challenging area to get membership growth in.
Uh-huh.
So that's a space that there's more males in that demographic interested in esports in this country than our AFL football. You know, and that says something, and people are surprised when you say that. But we want to be able to connect with them, engage with them, and then hopefully drive them to support the Essendon Football Club.
So how creative does the football club of today, tomorrow need to be beyond getting the core right to be competitive within each season that presents?
Very. You're talking more from a football perspective, you're talking more from a broader business perspective.
Probably both.
Well, I mean, the equalisation measures and competitive balance have put pressures from below and above onto your football department. You know, not many competitions, professional sporting competitions in the world have both a player cap and then a non-player cap, and I say a football department's been. And that's where you have to... And we are just the same as anyone, become more sophisticated in how you measure return on investment. And we're very much in a very early stage of being able to do that. But that's, you know, when I think about the investments and strategy division, their focus isn't just about broader business growth. It's about how we get greater growth and return on investment in our football department spend as well.
Mm. That's the start of a fascinating conversation, Xavier. It's great to have you in the studio. It's Essendon Membership Day, so become a Mighty Bomber today at efc.com.au. Throw your arms around the red and black and become a Mighty Bomber at efc.com.au. Good luck, and we'll chat regularly throughout the season, I'm sure.
Thanks very much, Jared.
Xavier Campbell, the Chief Executive of Essendon in the studio. Nathan Buckley about to resume his weekly slot on Waitley after the break. It was quite the journey through 2018 that we lived weekly through Nathan Buckley as the coach of Collingwood. We hitch our wagon to him again in 2019. Bucks, thanks for accepting the invitation and returning.
Well, I'm considering that I'm hitching my wagon to you, mate, so we'll agree to disagree on that.
How was Morwell?
It was good. Yeah, it was a good round off for us. Our last quarter footy was yuck. You know, we couldn't hit a target by hand or by foot, And I think our skills degenerated the game as much as any. But, we got through in good fettle body-wise. We've probably seen a lot of sides lose players with injury over the last 2 or 3 weeks, and that is a reality in the game. But we lost Reedy on the Sunday, but largely we've been able to round off a really solid preparation, and we've got a lot of individuals that are in good shape and in good form and ready to attack the early part of the year.
It was a curious last quarter, as you point out. Did it give you any sense of what close footy might look like under the rule modifications? Or because Carlton kept kicking behinds, it never quite went back to the middle enough?
No, well, it got back there. Like, there's no doubt the scores got level, and then we were able to kick a goal and go a goal up. The scoreboard was glitching as well. So I was talking to Darcy after the game. I said, "How did you handle that?" And he goes, "Well, I didn't know if we were in front, behind, or whether we were a draw, because at various times he looked up three or four times in about a 20 or 30 second period and the scoreboard had changed each time. So I think that like that's probably a reality of the country footy as well. So when he actually kicked long down the middle, he thought we were a point up. He was just being aggressive. It was actually a draw at that point. So that gave us a little bit of field position and we were able to score sort of in the next sort of flow of play. But the centre bounce stuff is very open. I mean, we know that that is a reality. The 666 makes it you know, impossible to put an extra number behind the ball when you're up by a small margin with a short amount of time on the clock. And it's really easy to... If you're trying to come back off the wing to support your back six, it's really easy for the opposition to man that up or to equalise numbers behind the ball. So because it's a long way from the oppo forward 50 to get to your back 50 or our forward 50 get to your back 50. So there are going to be close games that that if you win the centre clearance, if you're behind and you win the centre clearance, you're probably more likely to score than, definitely more likely to score than you have been before. And that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing.
Do you think, have you seen many strategies? Did you implement many strategies? Do you think there are strategies and people are keeping their powder dry? What was your impression through the past 2 weeks?
Well, we did quite a bit of centre bounce. You know, we started in late November. So I would suggest that we've done as much centre bounce as any club. And we've tried a whole heap of things, and I think what you get back to is there's not a great deal that you can advantage that you can get without giving up an advantage somewhere else. So there is you actually give a lot to try and get a bit. So I think it's largely going to come down to, you know, who plays man on man football better.
Okay,
you can bring your wings in really hard and potentially get an outnumber, you know, in the center, around the center circle, but to do that you're actually opening up a handball exit to if a winger sits out. So you can roll you can get a back to come in hard off the back to try and give you a little bit of support out the front door for the opposition, but you're giving a loose forward over the top. You can try and roll a winger back off the side, but you, once again, his direct opponent could be an exit, you know, at the side. So I think we worked out that you can trick yourself a lot easier than you believe. So it really is straight up and down, man-on-man football, and, you know, 4v4 in the middle, a couple of guys out in the side that are, there might be a few little ripples there, but and you're largely 6v6 on either end of the ball. Some sides will leave more gap than others. Some forward lines will be happy to leave more gap if their centre bounce is dominant. Others will roll their forward, like have their forwards run in a little bit harder if they feel like they need some more support for their centre bounce. But largely, if you've got a dominant four inside against any opposition, you're going to give up field position, or you're going to get field position pretty quickly.
Do you like the purity of that?
Look, it's a moment in time. It'll last for 20-25 seconds. We won't see as many repeat stoppages out of centre bounce, I wouldn't have thought. No, we won't. And scoring should be better. I mean, to see North Melbourne kick 5 centre bounce goals in a quarter against Port Adelaide is pretty amazing. North Melbourne, one of the better centre bounce sides last year. So whether that means that they can frank that with this rule, we'll find out. I think it's too early to really measure it until we get 5 or 6 rounds in and see how it is. I think the kick-in scores are lower this year than at JLT last year. So we never really know how it's going to come about, and the tactics that the coaches and each team brings is going to reflect the ultimate change that we see from the rule.
Is there a greater sense of mystery then going into this season than you would have experienced recently?
Oh, look, the idea of the rule changes is to try and open the game up and try to reduce congestion from what I can gather. There's no doubt that the centre bounce is a lot more open. The ground is a lot bigger. There's a lot more space through the middle of the field. The irony of that is you might get to the pointy end of the field quicker, and at the pointy end of the field, if you get a stoppage, well, then that's where it gets locked up generally. So the centre bounce as such hasn't been a place of congestion. The wings across the ground, the middle of the ground, is the widest part of the ground, the hardest part of the field to congest or to or to clog up inside each of the 50s, either your defensive 50, the opposition try and squeeze you in and keep you there, your forward 50, you want to open it up and keep it in there as well. But I think, so I don't know how much effect that will actually have. I mean, the jury's out. I think the shifts are interesting. I think they will be dynamic in some sense. When the game is close late, we will see games won on the ability to win your centre bounce and to score late in a contest. So I think they're worthwhile I think it adds a level of excitement to what we're going to see early in the year.
Have you enjoyed the sessions with your coaches while you've tried to come up with ideas and then gone out and implemented and then come back in and go?
Yeah, well, look, I think, and our players as well, we've actually given our players a lot of onus because, as we also know, the runners are not going to be as present on the football field. So therefore, we do a lot of our communication with our players when they rotate. So a lot of the coach communication actually comes through the comms on the bench to the players and generally to the leaders mid-quarter. So you're not going to miss out on that. But the players will need to rotate effectively without the runner. Some boys forget the clock and just get lost in the game and might be out there for 25 minutes without rotating, which is not optimal. It can blow them up for the rest of the game, and it can decrease your efficiency across the squad. But the leaders, you know, through centre bounce and kick-ins have been intimately involved. The players have been intimately involved in, you know, having freestyle sessions. You know, here's your centre bounce, see what you can make of it. Here's the kick-out or the zone, see what you can make of it. You know, explore what it feels like. What do you think are the best outcomes? What are the things we need to look out for? So the coaches and players alike have been doing that through the whole pre-season, and it's been a very dynamic, fluid process. And the reality is that, and you settle on a plan, but the reality is that the players and the leaders on field mid-quarter, without the runner, are going to have to make the determination of, you know, in the moment, this is what we need to do here and now. And so the understanding between coaches and leaders is crucial.
Are you okay with the restrictions on the runners?
Yeah, look, we've prepared to not have the runners, and like I understand where Bevo's coming from, it's probably a little bit it may be a little bit tongue in cheek because there's been a rule change. I think the last couple of years into round one or into our pre-season competition, we've had a rule introduced or taken away. I think it would be better to have. Personally, as a coaching group, I think we would like to have the capacity to send a person out there to send a message to a player, whether it's about the way that we want to play or whether it's a specific instruction for Pendles or a bit of information that he might be able to use whilst he's out there to flesh out his thoughts on and feelings on how the game is going and what's happening out there. But as I said, we probably don't miss out on a lot of that because of the communications through the bench. You probably, if there's a player who has lost himself in rotations, you need the hook. You'd like to have a hook, but you're not going to have it with the runner not being able to go out between goals. So you might get more broken play in that, or more broken down play, more transition in that regard, because you might see a bit more fatigue if the players are in control of rotations and aren't as mathematical or precise with getting it done.
And then might the old player gets lost accidentally on purpose.
Well, that's generally how it happens. So you do a lot of, you have a lot of conversation with those players, but I mean, talking about it on a Wednesday afternoon, saying, look, I think 8 to 10 minutes is your optimum, and it's really good, and then you come off at two, all the data here shows that you maintain your intensity. I'll do that. Yeah, minute 18. Remember what we were talking about?
More with Nathan Buckley after Meredith Gibbs and the news headlines. Nathan Buckley is in the studio. He will be each week throughout the AFL season. So we've worked through some of the rules and how they're playing out at the moment. What about the 50-metre penalty? So this is causing heartburn with fans. It's jarring to look at.
Yeah.
Whose responsibility is this? Should the players already know? Is the AFL too hardcore on it?
Well, the players know. And it's much like the protected space rule and some of those 50s that were given. Yeah, well, marginal, but then and it's a costly penalty. The penalty, clearly, the 50, and if you're giving up 100, that takes it to the nth. I can understand it. I can understand the spirit of the rule. You're trying to give the team that have been infringed and have the 50 a little bit more play, you know, the opportunity to play on when you've taken 30 and then come off the line and move the ball straight away. It's it probably stops the opposition from collapsing as hard as they have collapsed before at a 50-metre penalty, which looks like it congests behind the ball. So I think that's what the intent of the rule is. As long as the player that's working back on the mark isn't directly impeding the play with the ball, I think that, I mean, if that play, say that player is, the player with the ball is just faster than the player that's running mm-hmm. back on the mark and runs past him, as long as that guy then doesn't try to bump or tackle or halt the progress of the player with the ball, if he just then moves away, I think that's fair enough. I think the umpire needs to have a little bit of understanding in that regard. But you're also trying to read the intent of a person. We're trying to take away that part of it and make it more black and white. But the rules of the game are very hard to adjudicate. The umpires have got a very tough job. Sometimes they'll get it right and everyone will think it's wrong. Sometimes they'll get it wrong and everyone will think it's right. I think that's just the way the game goes. It's a quirk and I'm happy to embrace it.
So you're comfortable with this progressing?
Well, let's give it a bit of time.
Yeah.
Let's give it a bit of time. And yeah, there are going to be hundreds because there's going to be a player who has a brain fade and tries to stop the progress of that guy and he's no longer able to. You've either got to work back to the mark or move aside. And really, the smarter players will take advantage of the rules. They always have. The best players, the smartest players, the players that are on task and are going to take advantage of the rules and use them to their advantage. If you get a player that has a 50-metre free kick and has a ball in his hands, he's going to try and find a way to make it 100. So, and if you get a dumb player on the other side that gets taken advantage of, it's no use the supporters getting frustrated. Everyone knows the rules, and that's what smart players do. They use the rules to their advantage.
And that's footy in a nutshell.
It is. Probably
has
always been. It's just it's a big win. So there's a bit on it either way. So the smarter players are going to look for those loopholes even more.
Do the JLT games serve their purpose? Are they necessary?
I think they are. It's important for the AFL to have some organised lead-up games. And I mean, I don't know what it's like as a supporter to sit back. Yeah, we can be saturated by AFL. There's no doubt. There's the finals finish, and then you get into trade and draft, and it can feel like it's nearly a 12-month cycle. But when the games come around, I think people are genuinely interested. Supercoach has just gone gangbusters, and I don't know how many questions I've had about Isaac Quainer this year. I think everyone's trying to work out whether he's one of the rookies that they're going to put in. If you take a step back, most of it is around what people are interested in. So they're trying to put their teams together. They're trying to understand, they're watching other clubs so they can do that. It's driven a lot by what happens around the office.
Yep.
And that's, I think that's a good thing. I think it's great. For us, having those organised hitouts is important. We organised a practice match with Melbourne the week before we went to Fremantle. And to be honest, that was a really positive thing for us. We'd got sick of playing against ourselves. The coaches have got sick of coding both sides of the ball, to be honest. It's a difficult thing to do. And you get your real learning when you come up against a team that does things their way and you really find out about where you stack up. So the three games for us was important. Travelling and going to Freo, having a really hot game, travelling back, and then... playing against Carlton yesterday just rounds us off really well. It'll harden us up because we were clearly fatigued at the end of the game, and you know, that brings about growth in our fitness and in our resilience levels. So I think we've had I'm really happy with our preseason.
I had two conversations last week, one with Craig Bellamy, one with Adam Simpson, one about, and Craig's lived both sides of the winning and the losing. How do you, what do you take, how do you use it? What's the lot of the runner-up? And then Adam around, what did he study around repeat success? What's worked and what hasn't? How much thought have you put into being the runner-up and that, what that journey looks like into a fresh season?
How much thought? I have put a bit of thought into it, and the majority of the thought is to how much you can overanalyze either position. I mean, it is what it is. It's done. You can't do anything about it. We don't want to ignore the fact that there are. It's important to cleanse emotionally, in some way, mentally, in some way. But when I reflect on the game, and when we reflected on the game as a group, there's overwhelming pride with the way that we handled the situation and the occasion and the year. So it was a very positive season for us. The actual grand final day, our effort was great. Our intent was very good. There were times when we dominated the game. There were times when we were dominated, and there was ebbs and flows, as we saw. We didn't finish the game in front. You know, the other team bested us on the day, but it wasn't for lack of effort, and we handled the occasion. We just didn't. We weren't able to fulfil our responsibilities or do the basics well enough at key moments. And convert out the dominance that we had, especially in the first half. So we've looked at all that. We think we've absorbed it. You know, you never know. We think we've absorbed it. We're really looking forward. And I think that over-analysis can lead you to creating something that's actually not there. So whether it's over-analysing what Adam Simpson should be doing, you know, going into this year to make sure that his players don't drop off, or whether it's us thinking that, you know, we need to overreach. You know, we're very confident that we've got a good model, that we can make it a great model, but there's still a lot of work that needs to take place. Our mindset is to aim a little higher than last year, and we can't do any more than be the best of ourselves. So that continues, and we still believe there's a lot of growth in what we put out last year anyway. So where that gets us, I don't know. We'll find out. It's a tough competition, but and we've got some pretty hot games early in the season, so we're not really looking that much further than then.
When you say cleansing emotionally, do you do that individually or collectively or both?
Yeah, both.
Yep.
Yeah, I think part of it is about guys going and, you know, filling their cup with whatever their passions are outside of footy. And you know, we spent that basically the week after the grand final, we spent really close to each other and with each other. The grand final night is tough. The next day with fans, there was a bit more coming together and a bit more, the cleansing sort of starts a little bit. We had post-match or sort of post-season reviews, and they were all remarkably positive. It's amazing when you actually take a step back and reflect on the body of work of 2018, how positive that was man by man. And then by the time you get the Copeland on Friday, which is 6 days post grand final, you really are already looking forward. I felt like I was. And some of our players wouldn't have got to that point, or some of our people wouldn't have got to that point. But going away on holiday, they fill their cup. They're with family and friends and doing the things that they love. And we found that our boys were really looking forward to coming back to each other and getting to work. Pretty well on day one when we got together last year, and we think we've come along pretty well. Yeah, we're going to have some evidence and some feedback pretty soon.
And for you, in the catalogue of experiences you've had in your footy days, and you've lost one narrowly as a player, you've lost one narrowly as a coach. What will it mean to you? What will that game come to mean to you, either already or over time?
Well, it's the context of it right now is that it means that we that we were just unable to get over the line on at the end of a big game, that we just weren't able to execute towards the end of a big game. The context in a bigger picture can only be told, where it sits in, potentially what our future is. If it, if we drop right off, well, then it'll be said that that broke us. If we go forward to have, greater success over a, over a period of time, well, then it'll be said that it made us. I suppose we've got a decision on which way that is. So I could talk about it now, but it really doesn't do anything. As we said last year, our footy will do the talking, and that's really the only thing that you can do, your actions and what you're able to do against your opposition any given week is ultimately the product of the work that you've put in, or your mindset, or your emotional strength and resilience. And we're happy to be tested on that, because we believe we're prepared for it.
And is this weekend a breather for everybody? Is it? How do you treat?
Oh, it'll be. We'll do a little bit of work on Friday. We'll get back in for review tomorrow, because we do want to take the lessons and the learnings out of our game. So we'll review tomorrow, and the players will go through a normal flush period for their physical recovery. We'll do a little bit of work on Friday. And there's some boys who do more than others. Geordie DeGoey and Jaden Stevenson, Lyndon Dunn's got the all clear from the surgeon, sort of working back through full training the next 2, 3, 4 weeks. Will Hoskin Elliott starting to step up, Daniel Wells starting to step up. The boys that played on Sunday and Monday will get a little bit of load through. Then we'll take the weekend, and we're in Monday, and we play on Friday night. So it's a short week on the other side, but only 11 days from yesterday, or 10 days from now. So we're looking forward to starting the season and getting our hands dirty.
Nathan, thanks for coming back. We look forward to the weekly conversation.
Thanks, Jared. Cheers, mate.
Nathan Buckley, the Collingwood coach, a regular here on Waitley. It's Waitley for Red Energy, born and bred in Melbourne. That's Red Energy. And always ahead, the new BMW 3 Series has arrived at Doncaster BMW. Giles Thompson, welcome to SEN.
Morning, Jared.
How's the week stacking up for the All-Star Mile?
I think it's stuck out really well. So we had a great day at Flemington on Saturday with the Super Saturday and the new market for the ages. And we're ready now to get the All-Star Mile, the inaugural All-Star Mile, up and running and racing on Saturday.
Do you feel a little bit nervy about it? A bit? What's your mood towards the race that you've imagined being staged for the first time?
Yeah, I do get a bit nervy. It's a new race. We've put a huge amount of effort into it. We're very excited by what it was before we announced it. It's delivered in for us on that, we think, and we just hope for a great race on Saturday and a good crowd.
Has it taken a couple of turns along the way? Is it exactly what you imagined, or is it a derivative of what you imagined?
It certainly isn't exactly what I imagined. It's one of those things that when you go for it and you pull the trigger, you just don't know how it's going to pan out. You hope that people are going to engage with it and get excited by it. You hope that people are going to vote. And you hope you get a pretty good field. And I think we've got all of those. But there's been plenty of twists and turns. There'll be plenty more, I suspect, this week. I think one thing that people are yet to really see is the owner ambassadors. That's something which I think will grab us this week, as 14 people line up and potentially we'll win $250,000 on Saturday.
Will there be a difference in the way that the race is presented and the build up to it, or have you got special things planned for the day?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we've got the barrier draw today, which will be a pretty traditional barrier draw and will be fairly low key today. But then on Thursday night, we've got the owner ambassadors in town for a media event and a bit of a hoopla to sort of to razz that up. And it will be extraordinary to hear those stories of those people on Thursday night. And then Saturday, no doubt it will be a bit different. I know that Flemington have got a few things planned and Jetta playing. So there will be a bit of different feel to it, but it will have very much a VRC flavour. It's their race this year. But I expect them to have a few twists for us as we go through the day.
So with the maths I've done, there are 63,982 people responsible for the 10 horses who have voted in. How many do you hope of those 64,000 odd people might come to the track and fulfil their entire experience with the race?
Well, I'm impressed with your research, Jared. I think what's a good attendance is the question. And last year, The Blamey Stakes Day was the equivalent day, and there was just under 6,000 people. We had just under 20,000 yesterday at Super Saturday. I mean, our target is 15. We think 15's a pass. We'll be very happy with 20. We'll be ecstatic with more than that. So it's the first year. People need to sort of, I think, work into something like this. But if we can get a third of those 68,000, then that would be a good outcome.
What did you learn from the voting process?
Firstly, we lost a few votes because people voted twice and we pulled them both out, and people struggled a bit with the confirmation process on that. So we'll get that right. Beyond that, I think it went really well. 140,000 was the final tally once we removed those duplicate votes. That was beyond our expectations, and people really engaged with that. Some people say it was too long, some people say it's too short. I mean, the whole point of the All-Star, one of the reasons for the All-Star Mile is to get people talking about the race through the summer, talking about racing through the summer when they may not be talking about racing. It certainly achieved that, and the voting mechanism allowed that to happen. Now, should we have higher minimums for quality of horses, etc., we'll look at all of that. But generally, I think the voting went really well.
So it galvanised communities, and this is the way of a public vote, is the reality TV lesson, and it brought people together around particular horses, and thus we ended up with a mishmash through the public voting of level of horses. Were you comfortable with that? Is the fact that people galvanised around a horse a good thing, or does it detract from the title All-Star Mile?
I think people galvanising behind horses is an excellent thing. I think if we'd wanted, or we thought that we should have chosen the top 14 rated horses in the land, first we'd not have got them all, but secondly, we wouldn't have needed the public to vote. There wouldn't have been any engagement in that regard, and it just would have been just another top quality race. I say just another, but it would have been a great top quality race. We wanted more than that. We wanted to get people to engage with it. And therefore, you have to accept what the people vote for. And if they want to vote for Urban Ruler, that's up to them. However, we did have enough wild cards there. And of course, plenty of quality was voted in, that actually the top half of the race is as good a quality as you'll see anywhere this year.
So the bottom end, is there a risk that there might be horses embarrassed at the end of, with the top quality horses streaking away, and those who know they can't win being tailed off?
I think there'll be a gap between first and last, mm-hmm. Yes. But that's the nature of the beast. Yeah, this is a race where the top 10 horses have been voted by the public. They're entitled to vote who they want and for whatever reason they want. And we've got to accept that, and it provides great stories, great richness to this race. It will be a quality race on Saturday, there is no doubt. But there will also be a richness of story right the way through the field.
Will it be a credible race?
Oh, absolutely. I think it will be. I mean, you know, whether the 14th horse deserves to be in a $5 million race, it doesn't really matter. The top end of the field will be an extraordinary race. You've got Alizé, you've got Happy Clapper, you've got Mystic Journey. Great stories about those quality horses. And also, all six states are represented in the race. When was the last time a race was like that in Australia?
Have you let your mind wander at all over the last week or so? Imagine if you did have Winx and the Autumn Sun in the way that this was conceived, given what's been going on in the past few weeks.
Well, absolutely. And of course, we thought long and hard about, imagine if Winx did decide to change her program this time of year and come to the All-Star Mile. I think that might have scared a few off. She's done that in the past. But to have the two of them in the race, then you have a match race. We have, therefore, three bands of quality within the field. It would have been great. They were both dominated, of course, but we suspected that we'd be where we are today, certainly with Winx. It would be great if the Autumn Sun and Winx raced head-to-head. It would be fantastic anywhere in racing, anywhere in Australia, whether that's in the Queen Elizabeth in a few weeks' time or the Cox Plate in the spring. Just imagine if that happened. It would be fantastic to see. Whether we see it or not, I don't know. It's up to the connections.
Is that one of the drawbacks to racing for me at the moment is that we have the champion and the clear number one contender, and every other sport knows how to make this happen. But racing's got its intricacies where it's probably less likely to happen, the more likely to happen. And yet it would be the race of well, probably since Bonecrusher and our Waverley Star, it would be the best setup to a race since then. His racing's got to find a way, doesn't it, Giles?
Well, I mean, we've got $5 million on offer this Saturday, and it didn't do the job. So, and there's $4 million in the Queen Elizabeth in a few weeks' time. The problem I think we face is that, or the challenge we face is that the connections can do whatever they want with their horse. It's up to them. Of course, the trainer Chris Waller can guide them. But we're at their mercy. I'm not sure it is that obvious that all other sports manage to line up the champions against each other. You know, boxing springs to mind where that's very difficult. Even team sports around the world, you never quite get the teams lined up unless it's the World Cup or the Olympics. So it's a difficult thing to do, very difficult thing to do in racing. There's been plenty of horses that have been suggested to challenge Winx from all around the world, and that has, we haven't managed to get that together either. It's not as easy as it looks or ought to be, but it would be great, wouldn't it?
It would. Giles Thompson is the Chief Executive of Racing Victoria in the studio. Has the All-Star Mile put other races at this time of year in the shade? Have you heard that level of unease from a couple of the race clubs?
So we went for it. There's no doubt this year. We went for it with the All-Star Mile. We had to. You don't sort of launch something which you've got such great ambitions for and do it meekly. That's not going to help you. It doesn't help the Victorian racing industry to do that. So we went for it. We're not ashamed to have gone for it. And we think it's gone pretty well so far, bearing in mind the race hasn't actually happened as yet. Has it detracted from other races or other race days? I'm not sure it has. I think actually it arguably has added to it. So the fact that people have been talking about racing, and because of this race in particular through the summer, I think has really put an extra spotlight on racing as we've hit the actual peak period of racing. And also I think it's enhanced other races through the programme. So things like the Blamey, the Futurity, they were talked about because of the All-Star Mile in much more broader sense. So the Blamey, for example, has had 5 or 6 runners the last 2 years, had 15 last week.
Yep.
You know, that's a phenomenal turnaround. Now, is that all because of the All-Star Mile? Probably not, but it certainly helps put a focus on it as people try to, such as Le Romain, tries to get a place in the big race on Saturday.
So are you trying to bring the racing clubs with you whilst doing the right thing for Racing Victoria to get this up and going?
Absolutely. And you know, this is something, one of the special things about this race, I think, is that it goes round the 3 metro race clubs and they'll add their own colour and character to that. One thing that's been really pleasing from an internal perspective at Racing Victoria this time through is how well and how closely my team at Racing Victoria has worked with the VRC team. They've really enjoyed working together much more closely than they have done in the past, and they're going to deliver a great result on Saturday. I have no doubt about that. That's a really exciting opportunity for us as a racing body and for the clubs. Next year we'll be doing it with the MRC, and that will also be a great experience. We need to tweak and we need to work out who's going to do what, when and how, and how much we're going to invest where. But that's just something we can work through internally. But I think as an overall result, I think the Festival of Racing this year has been better for the All-Star Mile.
More broadly, how's racing come through the Darren Weir scandal?
Well, as you're aware, John, it was a pretty intense period of time and a pretty shocking period of time for everyone right across the sport when we had the raids at the end of January. I think that we got through that pretty well. I think we got through that in a pretty quick way. We got to where we needed to get to quickly. We were happy with that. I think also the broader sport were happy with that because they don't want these things to drag on. Once the shock of what actually was transpiring has passed, they want it dealt with quickly and swiftly. And we got that and enabled us then to focus on the actual racing. Because the racing is extraordinary. We know that the vast majority of people are doing the right thing. The sport's a great sport. Just look at the Newmarket on Saturday. What a great race and a great feature to be able to focus on. So it was important to get through that. It's only chapter one, though, and at some point we may be talking about this again in the future.
Have you had any level of unease as replaced Darren Weir horses have won in other circumstances for other stables, not necessarily knowing what the horses have been through with Weir?
Not really. I mean, I think that he had a huge amount of horses. I mean, there's no doubt that Darren Weir is a great horseman. There's no doubt that he had great horses. And so for those horses to go on to other stables where they've got great trainers looking after them as well, we expect them to continue to perform as they always have. I mean, they are good horses under good ownership and under good training regimes, and so that, therefore they continue to do well. I expect people to continue to talk about these particular horses, but I think people sort of understand where those horses have got to.
Does Racing Victoria's investigations remain active into WIA?
Yes, so our investigations are ongoing, as are Victoria Police's investigations ongoing. And as evidence comes to light and more evidence comes to light, then we'll respond as we need to. And I'm sure Victoria Police are considering how they're going to respond to it as well.
Do you work in concert with Victoria Police at the moment, or are they running their own investigations separately?
Well, to a degree, it's a joint investigation. But when you bring in, when we brought in VicPol last year, one of the upsides of bringing them in is that, of course, they have greater powers than we do, and therefore you can get an investigation more deeply. But at the same time, when you do bring them in, you lose a bit of oversight of what's going on, because they cannot openly share between Victoria Police and Racing Victoria. We cannot openly share all information. That's something that we would like to get changed. We'd like to have it a bit more open than it is today. But as it stands today, we don't get that insight, and therefore you lose some insight on that, and you sort of trust that the police are going to do what they need to do.
So you talk about this being chapter one. Are there potentially sort of more hurtful days for racing along the way as what's investigated and potentially more is revealed about what was taking place?
There may be. I mean, it's too early to say that there definitely is or isn't either way. But with ongoing investigations, it's highly likely that that both us and the police will consider what charges we may or may not want to lay in the future. They will be hurtful days if they come around. You know, all that we've dealt with so far is possession. We haven't dealt with use. We haven't dealt with anything else either. So that's all that's been done so far, and that's all that there's a line under at this point.
The other event today after the barrier draw for the All-Star Mile at Flemington is Les Carline's funeral, as you doubtless would have had a chance to think and reflect over what he has meant to racing, what he's meant to public life, what he's meant to media, and it's beautifully fitting that Flemington is the stage today.
It's great that it's going to be at Flemington. I mean, I've, as you can tell from my accent, I've only been around here about 15 years, so fairly new to the scene. But I've been aware the whole time of Les and what Les meant, not just to racing, but the broader community. And so this provides a reflection on that. It's an extraordinary career. I mean, there will be what he's done for people from a mentoring perspective, and what he's done for racing from a colour and movement perspective. It's extraordinary and sort of unparalleled, and hopefully he'll get recognised, and I'm sure he will get recognised appropriately today at Flemington.
When you read his words and when you heard him speak, what occurred to you about his connection to racing?
Well, it was very pure. It oozed passion for it. You know, people like me talk about the industry, and we're relatively tedious about what we talk about with racing, and I struggle for words. But someone like Les just was passionate, felt it. You could feel that he felt it, and he enabled you to feel it as well. And that's a great skill, and he'll be sorely missed.
Giles, thanks for stopping by on a busy day.
Thanks, Jared.
Melbourne United tied 1-1 with Perth after the first two games of the grand final series in the NBL. Friday night in Perth, Sunday in Melbourne, and that gets repeated this coming weekend. Vince Crivelli is the chief executive of Melbourne United. Vince, welcome back to the studio.
Thanks, mate. Nice to be here.
How do you feel middle of a grand final series?
I'm on edge. I'm not sure whether to be happy, whether to be angry, whether to be sad, but I'm certainly emotional. It's good to be alive at this time of the year in our sport.
It's crying out for a Wednesday night game, isn't it? Just to keep the continuity.
Yeah, look, I think the two games that were both played on the weekend, you know, record crowds. I was in Perth on Friday night, and they do an amazing job, have done for years. You know, they've set the platform for a tremendous, they've set a huge bar, really, in terms of how the game's supported over there. And then we had 10,000 fans come to Melbourne Arena and, you know, a long weekend and support our guys. So I'm sure that momentum would have carried into Wednesday, but you know, we get to sleep a few more nights before that third game.
So this is tied to the free-to-air contract?
Yeah, definitely tied to the free-to-air contract. You know, I know the league and the clubs all worked together on what their wish lists were, but, you know, there are other forces at play there than You've got to work with all of those little stakeholders, and this is what we've ended up with.
If you had your choice, that the games would be slotted a bit closer together?
Yeah, I think so. I think basketball's a real volume game, you know. We were talking a little bit before. I do think that the story builds with that volume, and to have those volume of games a little closer together maybe brings a little bit more of that story out in a smaller time frame. But I know that the players feel pretty good about having an extra couple of days rest, because the games are incredibly physical. They're tightly contested. You know, I know the scoreline. I think we lost by 10 on Friday and won by near 20 on Sunday. But that doesn't necessarily tell the story of how tightly contested every single possession is.
The other curiosity about Friday night was the timing. Obviously makes sense in Perth at 7:20, but it doesn't on the eastern seaboard. Is 10:20 too late for your fans?
Oh, I think so. But, you know, we've got a great group of loyal fans who tuned in, and I know our social media pages were pretty active during the game, so we know they're all tuning in and supporting us. We had a watch party here in Melbourne as well. It was really well attended. But yeah, I mean, ideally it'd be great to be here in Melbourne at 7:30 p.m. And we had that chance. We had a chance to secure a top spot, and we couldn't do it. So this is the price we pay.
The peculiarities of Perth. So I think anyone who vaguely knows basketball understands how powerful the Wildcats have been and have some understanding of the intimidating nature of going and playing there. So you were there on Friday night. Just describe the atmosphere and the role that it plays for the home team.
Well, they're primarily a member-based club, so it's very difficult for the general punter in Perth to actually get a seat at the Wildcats. I think a 13,000-seat venue, I think there's only 1,000 seats that they sell on any game night. So what they've been able to build over time is a lot of tribal behaviour. They've kept the recipe very, very similar game after game, year after year. And they've had real stability in their playing group, led by Damian Martin, who is out and out a genuine superstar of Australian sport. We don't hear too much of him here because he's out on the western side of Australia, but he's certainly a superstar over there. And over that period of time, with all of that stability's come behaviour at home games that, you know, is somewhat interesting to be a part of. You know, I think the interesting thing for our players, though, truthfully, is that they enjoy that. They actually enjoy the spectacle themselves. I don't think it really rattles them too much. If anything, I think guys like Chris and Casper, they actually draw energy from that from the crowd that's over there, but certainly creates a fantastic spectacle to be part of.
Does it influence the game? Because there are no variables in an enclosed stadium, courts the same size. There aren't distinguishing features from court to court to court other than the atmosphere.
Yeah, I think the energy that's produced by the crowd can influence games in different ways, whether that's some simple little mental errors, you know, missing a couple of free throws that ordinarily you wouldn't miss. You know, I know DJ went to the line and he's a 90-odd% free throw shooter and he missed his first four free throws, and he's a seasoned veteran and been a steady hand all year. Was that nerves or was it just a lack of concentration at the time? Probably a little bit of both, but I think the atmosphere played a part in that. Same too maybe with the officiating. You know, at times it can be those 50-50 calls. Under the pressure of 13,000 people all dressed in red, knowing your name, you know, sometimes that can also play a little bit of part. But I think for the most part, to be honest, Jared, I don't think our players are bothered by it at all. And I agree with your summation. There are no variables. It's just another court. It's a short plane ride. The time difference is probably the only factor I can think of that might impact the players' performance, because they are still on Melbourne time and it is 10:20 at night when they're playing that game. But our players don't fear it. They embrace it. I know that the guys actually really enjoy the atmosphere and they enjoy taking the air out of that stadium. They've done it multiple times.
Are there lessons in what the Wildcats have done and do that you look at, study and work out what's transferable?
Yeah, I don't think necessarily just in the Wildcats. You know, I think it's true of all sports, all great sporting clubs, and the Perth Wildcats are a great sporting organisation, period. I think this is their 30-odd, 30, 33rd appearance in a finals campaign, which is, you know, fantastic. And the success that they've been able to have on the court and off the court, we certainly look at. But so too do we look at all of the AFL clubs here. Melbourne Storm are somebody that I really admire as the way they go about doing their business. And I think they've got really good stability across all of their leaders, and they all play their part really, really well. There's not a whole lot of negative emotion out there. It's fairly pragmatic, and everybody knows the task at hand and the role that they need to play, and they get on with it. And I think we've learnt from that. As far as the game day preparation, I know 5 years ago when I first started in the role, I took a visit to Perth because I'd heard so much about it and I wanted to experience it myself. And I certainly got a lot of keys, if you like, off them for how we set up our game day experience, but then we've kind of Melbournised it,
yep,
if there is such a thing. And we've turned it into our own.
Have you had a go at dressing the whole stadium in one colour?
Yeah. Yeah, we have. Yep. We have done that in the past. But, you know, part of the appeal that we love, Melbourne, we talk about the brand of Melbourne, you talk about food, you talk about fashion, you talk about sport, you talk about arts, you talk about all of the different culture that is involved in our great city. And for us, we didn't necessarily see it as something that was necessary to create a vibe at our games. You know, we like the idea of the fan being able to come with their kids, casual clothing. They don't need to go and buy another piece of merch to be part of what the game day experience really is. But we have done it on certain, we have done it in certain times of the year, and we'll probably try to do it again a few times next season, more tied into a cause than, you know, a way of behaving in our games. I want people to come to our games as they are, be themselves, enjoy a couple of hours with their family, and let the game and the entertainment that happens around the game wash over them.
So let me ask you the most obvious question of all is, how big is Game 3? This does look like a team that's capable of winning a game in Perth, but there's a difference between being capable and going and getting it done.
Yeah, look, we've been unlucky there twice. I think we had a call that didn't quite go our way that would have won us a game there earlier in the year on Casper Ware, and the NBL came out and actually said that they'd made a mistake with that call. And then the second game, you know, Casper Ware, who's unbelievably clutch when it matters, missed what could only be described as a pretty easy layup with 4 seconds to play to put us up, which meant, you know, those two results go away and we sweep the series. We're not concerned about winning in Perth. What really has been the case with us this year has been just our own performances. As I said, we have had games this year where we've had a chance to really break away from the competition, and we lost those games for whatever reason. And then the very next night, backs to the wall, because you go from being a game clear in first to battling for fifth spot within the space of 3 days, and it's a completely different team. So the battle for us is really about us. Game three is critical, but we truly believe we can win one of the next two games in Perth. And it's not a lay-down mazair that you win a game in Perth and you come back home and win it here. It sounds great.
Yep.
From an operations and administration perspective, it's terrific, but not necessarily the case. We've got to win two out of the next three, and we believe we can do that.
So Sunday's either keep it alive or win the title. It's also Grand Prix Day. So what are the competitive tensions around Sunday for Melbourne United?
Well, we go on sale to the general public today at 4 p.m. Through Ticketek. So I encourage anyone that's looking to get a seat to get online today as quickly as they can, because those seats tend to go pretty quickly. And I do think that we have a different fan base to what the GP would experience. That said, the GP's certainly evolved in the last couple of years, I think, into more an event, much like what the Australian Open is. Not quite there yet, but certainly similar to that, where there are a lot of families and event goers that choose to attend the GP, and they make that choice months in advance. So it's yet to be seen how it'll affect us, but I'm expecting nothing short of a sold-out capacity crowd supporting the boys on Sunday at 2 o'clock.
Well, good luck for the weekend ahead. There's a lot riding on it.
There certainly is, mate, and I tell you what, I'd be more than happy for next week to just be in celebration mode, but I'm also pretty prepared for battle mode.
What night would Game 5 be if it goes that far?
It'd be Friday week.
Yep. Yep. So Friday, Sunday, Friday, Sunday, Friday. It'd be a big build-up if it does get to Game 5. Good luck, Vince. Thanks for coming in again.
Thanks, Jared.
Vince Crivelli's the Chief Executive of Melbourne United. So Sunday, so today, 4 p.m. tickets go on sale, $2.50 Sunday. $2.20 Sunday is Game 4. So be a part of it. We went Sunday. It was a fantastic atmosphere. It'll be great. It's Essendon Membership Day on SEN. Become a mighty bomber at efc.com.au.
the Sheffield Shield, a rare failure now for Marcus Harris. He's out for six. Trent Copeland's got him. So Victoria 1 for 15. Travis Dean is 8. Will Pekowski yet to score. He's out in the middle at Drummoyne Oval. Victoria won the toss, elected to bat. But Marcus Harris will have to cool his jets just for the time being in his quest for 1,000 runs in the Shield season. So he's on 914 after what has been a recent failure in these innings around his test selection. So out for 6. It is Grand Prix weekend. So as well as the Formula Ones, the supercars have always been part of this. They've been integrated in. It's for real. It was for real last year and it's for real again this year. And Scott McLaughlin has just got into town. He's come straight from the airport. I think he's on pole having got here in pretty good time. Scotty, welcome back to SEN.
Yeah, it was the quickest trip I've ever taken from the airport for sure. But what's, happy to be here.
What does Melbourne Grand Prix week now mean to the supercar drivers?
Look, it's a huge amount, especially this weekend. It's the 1,000th. I can't even say it. You know, can you say it for me?
The 1,000th?
Yeah, that's it. Race for supercars as a whole. So it's exciting. But now we race for points. So it's second year in a row that we've raced for points. So it means a lot. It's not just a test session anymore. And we go out there and have a good go and hopefully we come away with some biscuits.
What's the schedule? 3 races?
Yeah, 4. So we have a 1 on Friday, 2 Saturday and 1 Sunday before the F1. So excited.
And distances?
There's two longer ones, about an hour race with a pit stop in those. So I think we've got a compulsory pit stop of 4 tyres, no fuel. And then we have sprint races Friday, Sunday. So they just basically, it's you really want to qualify well for those races because it is quite tough to pass in some ways, but also you just track position is just key in a short race.
Is it a different dynamic to most of the other rounds?
Yeah, you'd say that. It's weird because we are second fiddle to F1. You know, everything's about the F1 and normally we're the main event. So the track time's limited. Sometimes our sessions get shortened. Which never happens. So you have to sort of combat that across the weekend, which makes it interesting, but it's all the same for everyone.
Do you like the F1s?
I do.
Yeah.
I really, it's a good way for us to follow it to start because you can follow all the behind the scenes action. We normally get a pass to walk in the paddock and, it's just a different world. And I'm really hoping Danny goes well in his new car. I think it might be tough at the start, but I think it's going to be a good move in the end for him.
Do you sneak into the odd garage and have a look?
Yeah, for sure. Obviously, with Shell sponsoring our car, we've got an association with Ferrari, which is really cool. So the last couple of years, we've done a couple of things with the drivers, which has been cool. So I met Vettel and Raikkonen and gone in through the pits, which is just, it's a laboratory. It's unreal, the amount of money that's in there, and it just, they would just blow us away.
Yep.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Have you ever been able to have a driver one?
No, but I'd love to. I mean, I would, you know, I'd do a lot of things to try and get one. My bum in the seat, but it's also a completely different dynamic of racing. You know, the way they use the aerodynamics and the forces that go through those cars is just unreal.
Yeah, so even for you with all your experiences, if you got in one, it would be a thrill.
Everyone talks about the braking in those cars. I know Jamie Wincup and Craig Lowndes have driven one a few years ago, an older generation car, but they just said it was just ridiculous. The way, you know, the feel of the car through the corners and stuff was pretty good, but the braking was just phenomenal. It's just the way you could just hit the brake, all of a sudden it just would stop from 280 kilometres to 70 k's and, you know, 100 metres. Unreal.
How many of the supercar drivers growing up or in their formative stages would have gone, oh, the dream of F1 sort of sits in the distance, can it be pursued?
Well, you've got to, I think for me, you had to go one way or the other. You had to go to Europe or you stayed here and did Australia with the touring cars and stuff, which is still a very cool career. And you know, if I wanted to go to F1, and similar to Ricardo and all that guy, those guys, they left when they were 15, 16 and lived over there by themselves and spent a lot of money. And very few make it, very minute. And it's some ways it's a completely different style of racing. You've got to be a bit smaller, a bit of a jockey. I've always been a bigger guy. I was always born to be a touring car racer, I think. So, a bit of a big unit.
Would the skill level be different or would, when you were all 14, would you have all had the same
the same basics.
Yeah, I think we all grow up with the same basics, karting, but it's when you go into bigger... I'm definitely a better driver than I was in go-karting back in the day. You know, you learn so much experience, but there's also a lot of things that I didn't need in karting that I had to learn for touring cars, and that would be the same for Danny Ric and all the people in Formula 1 and IndyCar and all those aerodynamic race cars, open wheelers. You know, go-karting teaches you the fundamentals of racecraft, qualifying a car, all that sort of stuff. But when it comes to chassis and telling the mechanics, the engineers what you want from the car, it's you got to learn a whole new facet of, you know, your career.
Scott McLaughlin's in the studio ahead of the Australian Grand Prix, where the supercars have a key role to play. Tell me the different dynamic. So you're the defending champion now. Mm. You go to Adelaide, you dominate there. How did you approach season 2019?
Yeah, I put a lot of pressure on myself to start, and I had to sort of calm myself down on Saturday. I was a bit, I sort of felt like, you know, I'm the reigning champion. I have to win. You know, I have to perform and, you know, prove that it's not a hangover, a bit like my Bulldogs in 2016, but we'll forget about that. But, no, look, and then I had a big chat to my mindfulness coach, Emma Murray, and basically the word acceptance sort of came into it, and we had a big think about it, and it calmed me down a lot. And, I definitely now I'm just probably more enjoying, you know, the challenge of trying to go back to back.
Is it to get the first race done and to be successful, that does it, even with acceptance, does it come as any sort of relief?
It's a relief, but it's a confidence booster too. It's like, I haven't forgotten how to drive. The team's still good. We've got great cars. And you all have that little doubt in your mind that, you know, can you go back to back? Can you do what you can with a new car and stuff? And certainly that's something that I had to discuss with Emma, and you know, coming out of the weekend was probably the perfect weekend, a lot better than we actually could have thought or could have hoped for.
So we'll come back to Emma shortly, who came into the program a couple of weeks ago, so people would have heard that. A new car, so the Mustang.
Yep.
How long does it take you to get to know a car?
It's funny, you know. I felt pretty at home straight away. As soon as we started testing, it felt good. I think if you put me in the car with a blindfold on, I wouldn't know, apart from the mirrors, if I was in the Mustang. It's very similar inside the car. Nothing's changed ergonomically. It's more just, you know, the feel, and there's very minute feelings that feel different. So that made me comfortable straight away. The first couple of laps, I was like, oh, this just feels like home. And it was just about, you know, just doing a couple little things to make me feel comfortable, and away we went.
So how would you describe the, I'll be a bit clumsy here, but the partnership between the driver and his car?
I don't know how to describe it. I think you've just got this... I remember my last car, you know, it was the most successful race car for me ever. And you know, I just knew what vibrations and what, you know, what noises it made and whatever. It's kind of like how a jockey talks to a horse, you know. I don't know. I just had that feel, and I feel like, you know, when I jumped in the Mustang, it was all new again. It's just about, you know, learning it, taming it, all that sort of stuff. Sure, it does a couple of different things, and the steering feels a bit different and all that sort of stuff, but it's very small, and I think it's a testament to the team that I got behind me. They built an amazing car that's very similar to what I had. All the setup of the pedals and the seat is all the same. So when I jump in, it feels like my last horse, which is pretty good.
What is the competitive tension like? What's the dynamic like with Holden and Nissan with the Mustang coming in?
Oh, it's been a few tears. There's been a few ups and downs. You know, obviously, you know, we've come out really strong, and there's been some talk that our car is pretty strong, and we've just got to, you know, put our head down and not worry about the politics of it all. I've definitely seen in the Holden and the Nissan that there's you know, with this new spring setup, that their car isn't as good through the corners, and I can see that. So when I can see it, it's obviously going to be a lot worse in their cars. So I'm just proud of the guys. They've built me a great car, and it's really balanced from the outset. So, you know, I think we've combated the new changes really well.
Does that change as the season unfolds? So is there much that Holden and Nissan can do to make their adjustments to be the way that they want to be and to compete?
Yeah, well, I think it's actually, a lot of it's not on the outside of the car, it's more internally. We've gone from a twin spring package where you can control the entry and the exit of the corner. Well, now you've only got a single spring, which is a control part for the whole field, so you can only control one part. So if you've got understeer or not enough turn, you've got to deal with that. So yeah, the car that we sit on the grid, even our car, and, you know, at Adelaide last week, you know, that will be completely different underneath the car when we get to November and Newcastle. You know, the development rate in supercars and motorsport as a whole is huge. And, you know, it takes a lot of money, a lot of brain power, but, you know, that's why we're all chasing that same, that advantage that you get, that little tenth, that little hundredth, and that's why motorsport's so cool.
So how intense is the rivalry? So is your natural rival Red Bull at the moment?
Our whole team, we pit next to each other. Yeah. All we want to do is beat each other. There's a healthy respect. I fully respect Shane, Jamie, his team. Sometimes I don't agree with some things that they go about business in some ways and how they go about in the media and that, but it's one of those things where that's what sport does. It's just so competitive and dog-eat-dog type stuff, and that's why we love it.
And it elevates the sport, doesn't it? I mean, when I was growing up, Ford and Holden, it was a thing, and you only had to glance into the Bathurst to understand what that was. Is it as tangible right now? Can the sport really, in a way,
benefit?
Use that to engage?
I think so. And I think you've got a really healthy fan base where they're either red or blue. That's it. And it's very cool. Obviously, we've got the Nissans there as well, but predominantly it's our team versus Red 888. And I'm so excited to be a part of that. And like I said, I think for the sport as a whole, I think we should really just enjoy it and just enjoy it. There's politics going on, off track, on track, whatever. But I know when we get out of the car, myself, Shane especially, you know, we'll shake hands, get on with it, have a beer, and then go again the next race, which is very cool.
The book that you put out, I know you were here a few weeks ago with Breakfast, Road to Redemption, A Championship Journey. Now that people, are you coming across people now who've had a chance to read it? And what sort of conversations are they having with you about it?
I said to Hodgie on the way in, we've had a lot of positive conversations, you know, a lot of stuff that, you know, I don't think people have seen a motorsport book kind of like this or even a sport book as much. I think it's, you know, I don't want to toot my own horn too much, but, you know, I feel like if I was growing up and I could read this book as a sportsman coming up through the ranks, you know, I think it's quite cool to see, you know, the ups and downs that I had and how I had to combat that. And I think Timmy's done a really good job at putting it all together and the photographers as well.
And Emma Murray did the closing word, and that so brings us back. How much did you think about how open you were prepared to be? You have laid out your vulnerabilities brilliantly in the book, and it is what sets it apart. Did you think through, am I prepared to do this?
I remember Hodgie coming to me with the idea of the book and said, if this comes off, it's going to be an awesome story. Well, I thought he had rocks in his head because I didn't really want to speak about that whole 2017 thing ever again. But I actually found out that it made me feel better about everything. It made me stronger as a driver and as a human being. And I feel like, you know, it was certainly, you know, laying it all out on the table. I think for me, I want to be a role model for some young kids come up through the sport and stuff. So, you know, if I can show that, you know, seeking help, whether it is for a motorsport or whether it is for anything, you know, with mental stuff, you know, outside of the car, you know, off track, or if it's just a normal human being, I think it's important that you talk to someone. And I was struggling more than I actually knew.
When Emma spoke to us, so performance mindfulness is how she thinks of it. So she was able to tell us from her side quite brilliantly, and the afterword is a splendid piece of writing. What's it meant to you? Has it actually opened up the possibilities to be the sportsman that you felt you could be?
I just feel like I'm looking more than just, you know, just the obvious things now. I'm going for that extra 1%, you know, 2% to, you know, be a top of my own game. I don't really care if my opposition don't do it or they do it or whatever, but I know that when I go out in that car that I give my best, and I know that that's 100%, where before, you know, I probably wasn't at that 100% level. And I think that puts a confidence in myself, but also my team. They understand what I went through and what I was thinking throughout that time and how I grew. And it's very cool. And, you know, Emma, like you said, that afterword is just amazing. And some of the stuff that she said in that afterword, I didn't even know she was picking up on my eye movements. And she's just a wizard. She's an unreal and an absolute commodity to us.
Does it make it... does it make you either more self-conscious, or does it actually just strip all that away? This is completely natural. It happens across all sport. What you feel is what Will Pekowski feels. It's what Jack Revolt feels. In a way, does it stitch you into the whole sporting landscape?
I think that made me understand that we're all very similar. You know, I thought I was completely different to those two guys, and you know, any sportsman, sportswoman in the whole entire world. But we all battle the same problem, and that's also, you know, expectation and putting pressure on yourself, and not thinking of the outcome more than, you know, what I, you know, focusing on what I needed to do to get the right outcome. And I think that's definitely put it all in perspective for sure.
Do you expect that that's a relationship that will serve you well through your sporting days?
Oh, absolutely. I think Emma's become one of the closest people apart from my family, you know, in my whole entire life. And we've only known each other less than a year. So I love her like a sister or an auntie or whatever you want to call her. So she's an amazing woman and someone that I'll definitely keep close to my side for the rest of my life.
Let me share a couple of messages with you before we finish up. I know you've got a book signing to get to. Yep. When Mark Winterbottom went to Holden, I unliked him straight away. The Ford versus Holden rivalry is still alive. That's from Danny.
It's awesome.
So that's reassuring. And this one from James. Would there be a big difference for Ricardo between last year's Red Bull and his Renault?
I think you'll probably notice it more so off track. You know, I think he'll be doing a little bit less media stuff or whatever and probably a bit more happier. And that's got to translate into some good stuff. I think the car itself, it's hard to say. I think the Red Bull will be a little bit stronger, but I think, you know, I think Danny's thinking about future and I think he's set himself up well.
So you've got the book signing at Southland at midday, tomorrow at Robinson's at Emporium in the CBD. Do you enjoy signing the book and handing it over to your fans?
I remember the first time I rolled into my book signing in Adelaide, I was a bit weird. I was like, well, I've got a book now, which is quite cool. But yeah, certainly we've had a massive reaction. All my fans have come out and supported. There's some people that have bought it that are just supercar fans, not necessarily mine. So yeah, it's exciting. But hopefully we can get a few more people along.
Mm. No, I'm happy to tell you it's a crossover book, whether you're a motor racing fan or not. There's absolutely something in it for you. So it's available at the track all weekend. That's where you'll be performing. Yep. Good luck for it.
Thank you, Jared. It's going to be an awesome weekend.
Scotty McLaughlin, who's part of the 360 family. We'll put him together with Jack tonight, as we won't have the same conversation because I won't get a word in once Jack sits down with him. It'll be great.
Yeah, of course.
All right, head to Southland. Scott McLaughlin and his book, written with Tim Hodges, Road to Redemption Championship Journey, and he started his championship defence in fine style. Your calls, 1-300-736-736. Scotty McLaughlin and Supercars, the mile, the all-star mile, the barrier draw that's come through, all matters footy. We'll work through some of those after the break. 1-300-736-736. You can text 0433-98-1116. This is Waitley for Red Energy, born and bred in Melbourne. That's Red Energy. And always ahead, the new BMW 3 Series has arrived at Doncaster BMW.